Time now for another prolific Australian expat, one of our most esteemed authors, David Malouf. He now resides in a small hilltop village in southern Tuscany.
With me now is one of Australia's most esteemed authors, David Malouf. Mr. Malouf has won a number of prizes for his fiction and poetry. His novel, An Imaginary Life, won the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award in 1979, and it was first published in the United States and was highly acclaimed by the critics there. His books Child's Play and Fly Away Peter have just been published here in paperback by Penguin. David Malouf, although, as I said, one of Australia's most esteemed authors, lives in Tuscany and he visits Australia from time to time. David, where do you live, in fact?
I live for about, for varying lengths of the year. Now it's got down to being about 5 months of the year. In a very small village in southern Tuscany. That's a place called the Maremma, which is really a very marshy part of Tuscany that was until, I think, the 30s, almost uninhabitable. So it's not very highly developed even now. And I live in one of the little hilltop villages there, about 800 people. Pretty isolated. I don't have a car or a phone, so I'm...
What's it like? What do the people do?
The people all have small plots of land just outside the village where they grow enough to live by. There are some quite big farmers there who grow wheat, sunflowers. Everybody grows grapes. There are olives.
Well, how do they regard you? As a strange foreigner in town who writes books?
Yes. Italians will accept anybody as long as they know what you are, as long as they have defined you. And I'm defined as, il professore is what they call me, the professor. That just means somebody who's been a teacher. And they know I'm writing because they can hear the typewriter clacking away. And so once they know that, I've got a place. I mean, I think now after 5 years, they'd think of the village as being different if that typewriter weren't sort of clacking away and if I weren't there. I might say that I'm called the professor because the very old lady in the village that I bought the house from, who's now become my sponsor, she became my sponsor in the village, and I eat there on Sundays and I'm part of that family. She insisted that I was the professore, and that's part of her claim to dignity, not mine. And when I once said to her that I would prefer if people called me by my name, she said, "You know, you mustn't let them. If I hear anybody doing that, I'll really tick them off."
Was it at all difficult for you as a foreigner to buy property there?
No. I mean, you need to be led through the maze. It's a considerable maze. And in fact, the most difficult thing of all was I went to the lawyer. And I said, I'm buying this house. And he said, "Yes, that's fine." He said, "I must tell you, you know, that you must have a number in the fiscal code to do that." And I said, "Yes." He said, "But you're not a resident, are you?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, you know, only a resident can have a number in the fiscal code." And I said, "Are you telling me that I can't buy the house?" He said, "No, I'm telling you what Italian law is. Now I'll tell you how we get around that. You must go to the Ministry of Finance in the local city, and you must ask them for a non-existent number in the fiscal code." And I thought, well, I've been in Italy long enough already to know how difficult it is to get anything that exists. So I went along to this ministry and said, "I've come to get a non-existent number." And they said, "Yes, room 28 on the third floor." And I went up there and a man went to a drawer marked non-existent numbers. And I bought my house.
If you have no car, how do you get around?
I stay in the village.
What's the nearest city?
The nearest city is Grosseto, which is a biggish, very new place. It's very like Australia, in fact. It's a town that looks... It's what Italians really want. They don't want all those narrow streets and churches and paintings and stuff. They want Australia or America. And Grosseto is an old town with a very old centre, a big fortress, star-shaped fortress. But the town itself is very modern, and I like it. I mean, I always take people there to show them what Italy really is rather than what we think it is.
Well, what is it about Tuscany? Because you have travelled very widely. You've lived in England, you've travelled in the United States and throughout Europe.
Yeah.
Why did you choose Tuscany, of all places, to make your second home?
I certainly wouldn't have chosen an English-speaking place because I was, in fact, not wanting to make myself really an expatriate in that sense. I think if you go to an English-speaking place and you're a writer, you get willy-nilly drawn into the literary life of that place, which I certainly didn't want. I'd been to Italy lots when I lived in England. I knew it was a place I could handle. and I know Italians are sort of easy to live among, and it was cheap. And that was really the thing that drew me there. I also had friends there I knew would help me, as I said, through all the maze of difficulties in acquiring a place and settling.
I have read that in contrasting Australia and Italy, you have said that the Italians have a great sense of play, which the Australians lack, and that's best illustrated by contrasting the drinking habits in the two countries.
Yes, I think one of the things is Italians do everything very openly. Everything is done with other people, and in some ways for other people. And so they don't go away by themselves, it seems to me, and do anything. I mean, children, for example, are not encouraged to develop lonely habits. You know, we were always complaining if kids need to be entertained all the time, we feel they ought to be away amusing themselves. No Italian would allow a child to go away and amuse himself. He's supposed to be an absolutely socialized being. And to that extent, you know, you sometimes feel, I don't know what kind of inner lives they have or if they're encouraged to have any inner life at all. They tend to do everything openly and with other people and socially. And so drinking is also a social thing like that. So they behave well all the time. So they have no conception that anybody would ever drink to get drunk. That is not one of the aspects of drinking that they can understand. That's very different, and it does represent a different kind of thing. We drink for our private reasons, and they drink for public reasons. They drink because if you're eating at a table with people, you're supposed to have a glass of wine in front of you and sip it. But they don't. I've been at, you know, a dinner party with Italians of eight people where barely two bottles of wine would get drunk.
The other point that you made in what I had read that you had said about the two countries was that a bar in Italy, unlike one in Australia where it has a sole purpose, and that is to dispense drinks, in Italy you would be able to buy ice creams, coffee, a whole range of other things that you might also want in the bar. But of course in Australia, not only is that not a part of our social tradition, it's almost positively forbidden by law.
Yes, there was a long time in Queensland. I think it was sometime in the mid-60s in Queensland before you were allowed to eat and drink in the same place. That was regarded as extraordinarily immoral, that you should eat and drink in the same place. Hotels were forbidden to have counter lunches, and restaurants were forbidden to have drink. That's an amazing, how that came about, one couldn't guess.
Well, it's English, I would.
I suppose it's English, but you have. You have your pork pies and sandwiches always in pubs in England, and your ploughman's lunches. Not sure that it ever. I don't know how that came, but certainly a bar in Italy is a central social place. In the village, the bar is the place where people go and play cards, go and read the newspapers, drink, have coffee. You know, it's where you meet people. It's open. Children can go into the bar. Children troop into the bar to buy their ice creams and may also sit down and read a newspaper. No one thinks that's immoral either.
Well, all this is leading around because I wanted to talk to you about your book Child's Play, which is the story of a terrorist assassin told in the first person by the assassin. As I read it and thought about what you'd said about Italy, that one of the characteristics of Italians is that they are melodramatic and extravagant. And I was thinking as I was reading your story of Fellini's film Amarcord, in which he showed what happened when that extravagance and that ostentation was combined with something as deadly as a uniform and making the trains run on time and invading Abyssinia, that there's an operatic quality about the Italians which can easily turn into tragedy. And the phenomenon of the urban terrorist seems to bear that out. It's something which can happen in Italy. I can't imagine it happening in Australia.
Yes, this business of everything being seen and everything being public and social means, of course, that you're always thinking of an audience. And that does make life in Italy very public and very like a spectacle. And what happens when you have a spectacle is that forms become ritualized. And, I mean, Italy is a place that seems to me, Italians have very little violence in them. But they have produced a public ritual of violence, a great spectacle of violence, but it's all out there. It's as if that didn't come from inside the people at all. It's all there to, you might even say, to siphon off aggressive feelings. You have this great public thing, and that is, you're unlikely to get bashed up in an Italian city by somebody who just lurches out at you in a violent fit. The people who'll get killed are either people who are involved in the mafia or the Camorra, or people who have been chosen to be killed publicly by terrorists. And that's a very different kind of society from ours. It's part of the whole externalizing quality in Italian life, I think.
Mm.
One of the things I want to say is, I mean, Italians are usually thought of as being very romantic. In fact, they're very, very rational. And they think of themselves as being like the French. They think of themselves and the French as having a Mediterranean quality of absolute rationality, as opposed to German and English emotionalism. And they think of the sort of the Romantic movement, for example, as being a purely Northern European phenomenon, and themselves as being cold, hard-headed rationalists. And
how can anybody be so mistaken about themselves?
Well, I think all peoples have notions of themselves that they're trying to live up to. I mean, the Italians are always the people they are always running against are the French. I mean, that's the people they see as their models for what they are really like.
Mm. Will you go on living in Tuscany forever? I mean, will you keep your house there?
I don't ever make forward plans very much. And when I first bought the house, I was so astonished at myself for having made such a kind of radical move that I felt I had to live in it all the time to justify to myself and other people the fact that I'd done something so kind of extraordinary. I'm now pretty easy about that, and if I lived in that house for 2 months or 3 months a year, I wouldn't feel I'd done something absolutely stupid. It's a very good place to work, that's what I've found. And over this 5 years, I mean, I've got a goodish amount of work done, and that's largely been achieved by being in that place, which I think of as a writing house, with really nothing to distract me and nothing to do except work. And I quite like that kind of discipline. I think there's a bit of the discipline of that rather awful old writer and that rather awful terrorist in me.
Well, it's the contrast between the monk and the terrorist that you draw also in the story.
Yes, well, you can't actually get an awful... writers have to sit down at a desk quietly and by themselves and work. There's no way... That notion that people often have of the writer, I think it's based on kind of the prototype of Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald, that what writers are doing is sort of swanning around Europe to bullfights and sitting in cafes and somewhere along the way getting a bit something written. That's just not it. I mean, you're sitting for long periods at the time alone, and you have to be very disciplined to do that, and I find it easiest when there are no distractions.
Well, David Malouf, thank you very much for being with me this morning. I've been talking to Australian author David Malouf, whose books include Child's Play and Fly Away Peter, which have just been published by Penguin in paperback in Australia, and also his fine novel based on an incident in the life of Ovid called An Imaginary Life. David, thank you very much for being with
thank
me this
you,
morning.
Jerry.
That was David Malouf with Terry Lane in 1983. I hope you've enjoyed today's program. We'd love to hear your thoughts, so drop by our website and leave a comment at abc.net.au/rn/replay. You can also listen online there and download podcasts. Our sound engineer today was Phil McKellar, and Sarah Corbett was our producer. Many thanks, as always, to John Spence in Archives. I'm Kirsty Melville. Do join us again next week. But we'll leave you today with more of Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony.